Hello and welcome to this interview. I'm Megan Gibson, co-host of the Trauma Super Conference. Today, I'm speaking with Mark Walsh, the founder of the Embodied Facilitator Course, Embodied Yoga Principles, the Embodiment Podcast, and SANE Ukraine Trauma Education Project, as well as the Embodiment Conference. With an honors degree in psychology and 20 plus years of yoga experience, as well as an Aikido black belt and 25 years of experience doing other martial arts, it's clear he has a dedicated life to embodied learning. Mark Walsh, thank you so much for being with us today.
Pleasure. Nice to meet you, Megan.
Nice to meet you as well. It's about time. So I know that your work in trauma is kind of focused around embodiment, obviously, as we just heard from your intro. So what does that mean to someone who's new to their trauma healing journey?
You won't think your way out of it. So trauma really brought the body back to therapy. So, that, you know, talk therapy is a good thing. I've had talk therapy myself. But what people discovered when they started working with trauma is that it was a really physiological thing. People, you know, it's fashionable to talk about nervous systems, but actually our whole physiology. So when people started looking at trauma, they say, hey, we need to get people back in the body. Now, there's a dissociation often associated with trauma. You know, that's part of what defines trauma is overwhelm. So people leave their bodies or a fight or flight being stuck in a body that's not very pleasant to be in. You know, it's agitated. That's what they say in 12-step programs, irritable, restless and discontent. Mm. You know, and the idea of embodiment is about coming home to the body. Poetically, we could define it as a skill set. I've kind of very much mapped it. I train all the coaches and I've very much mapped it as a skill set. In terms of trauma healing, it's part of the problem, the disassociation, and it's also part of the solution. And it's not the only part. I think we can look at trauma holistically, you know, psychologically, spiritually, in terms of communities and social systems. But I think if we ignore the body, we ignore a really critical piece. And that is what, you know, some of the sort of great names and the Bessel van der Kolks and the Pete Levines and the Gabor Maté is that's what they found. So for me, as someone who trains embodiment coaches, it's absolutely essential to make sure they're trauma aware and the embodiment piece helps a lot of people working with trauma.
Absolutely. And it's funny too, because so far in purely talking about accessibility, what we have readily accessible to us, to those who are privileged enough to have the means to find, you know, therapy or help, has been very cognitive, very top down, very thinking your way through whatever your problems are and whatever you're trying to heal. So it's no wonder, you know, the system itself has kind of built for us to just keep dissociating and keep separating our bodies from the process. And so what are you hoping for the future as far as how integrating embodiment into the thought process and mainstream kind of therapy and healing work? What are you hoping for the future for accessibility?
Well, we live in a disembodied culture. And that is a conspiracy. We live in a culture that keeps people separate from their bodies because that's where our health is. That's where our well-being is. That's how we become empathic and connected, which is the basis of our sanity. That's where our values are. So we can't be controlled if we're in touch with that. So, you know, the society we're in is pretty disembodied as a result of trauma, but also a result of technology, also a result of social systems, the speed of modern living, there's various factors, non-connection with nature, non-movement, you know, there's various factors that are involved in that, trauma being one. However, the body is making a comeback, like a 70s rock band. It's making Aerosmith on tour again. It's making a comeback in that people are going crazy and getting addicted. And we see this across the world, the stats of drug addiction, suicide, mental health problem, you know, just walking down the street in most cities in England, it's pretty bloody obvious, I think, in the States too. And so therefore people are going, okay, what about yoga? What about mindfulness? And there's some problems with those things, how they're being presented, how they're done. However, generally, I think the body is coming back in a big way because it has to. So we do see sort of forces for disembodiment, postmodernism being another one. And we do see forces for embodiment and that natural tendency to want to return to the body, to sort of come home to the safety and sanity and enjoyment of the body. But let's talk about enjoyment. You know, on trauma conferences, it's easy to talk about everything that's bad and see things through that lens. But yeah, I'm not sure if that answers your question, but maybe
it does. Yeah, and it leads me down the right road for sure, which is that, you know, I guess what I hear you saying is that it makes sense that we've been so separate. Like all of capitalistic society is engineered to keep us separate from our bodies and just keep us producing and
separate from ourselves, separate from each other, separate from our values and spirit, and separate from ecology. So the four disconnections, we could call these. So therefore, what do we need? We need self-connection, self-regulation. We need co-connection, community co-regulation, eco-connection, so eco-psychology, you know, there's a whole eco-embodiment movement, and some form of spirituality, meaning, higher purpose, some form of coming back to that which is significant to us.
And what's been your experience personally, and I know you also certify coaches and teach coaches in embodiment practice, what is your experience on assessing what the first step in helping somebody get guided back safely into being embodied is with somebody with trauma history?
Yeah. I mean, should I talk about my personal story a little bit?
Yeah, please do. Yeah.
Like, and then we'll kind of come back to that. I think it is relevant in that, you know, I was sort of hypercognitive as a child, really good reading books, read the whole school library, you know, high IQ, all that. But I was miserable. And I grew up in an alcoholic household. And I was like, you know, on some level, unconsciously, I was like, screw this, I'm out of here. Meaning I'm out of my body. This is unbearable. You know, this is too much. And that led me into, first of all, to try and sort of find an escape in the mind. But I, you know, I found that just wasn't viable. I found myself unhealthy mentally, physically. I found myself unable to do human relationships, which are based on empathy and connection and embodiment. I found myself with all sorts of issues and my own alcoholism, for example, by a fairly young age. And I had some sort of inclination the body might help because I wasn't educated in that. Like school didn't really, it just did physical fitness. And I wanted to learn to fight because I was involved in some illegal activity. And I thought martial arts might be a good idea for that. And I went to a martial arts dojo and it was calm and ordered. And there was power being expressed without brutality. And on some level, my whole being, my whole soma went, yes, this is what you need. So for me, the first step was discipline. It was self-regulation, co-regulation as well in that saying. For me, that was the first step because that was the body, but it was like, okay, it fit with my current values at the time. Okay, this is masculine, combative, it's allowed. You know, I wasn't ready to learn dance yet. I, you know, later found dance and yoga and other things, but I wasn't well regulated enough to sit down and meditate. I was too traumatized. But martial arts was my in because it had the movement, it had the cultural fit, it had the mystique of the East, which can become a barrier later, but was good at the time. And most of all, it had that sort of order and self-regulation to help a chaotic, dysregulated human feel at ease and safe. You know, what could make you feel more safe than learning to be a badass? Right? It's like, I can kick people's asses now. It's just like, you're like, people are like, I want to feel safe. It's like, no, I want to be safe. Fuck feeling. Yeah. So for me, it was martial arts. For someone else, that might be too much. Yoga might be a better in. For someone else, it might be a dog. You know, like the co-rate, you know, like humans are complex. Have you noticed, Megan? They're complicated. Dogs are easy. They're nice, aren't they, dogs? They just love you. They're great. My wife likes cats, you know, like it might be an animal. It might be nature. It might be, you know, I mean, I've chosen to live in the countryside because I find it soothing. I find it relaxing compared to the big city. For some people, they need a spiritual way in. So I think there are, you know, because we talk about spiritual bypassing as a bad thing, but that might be all someone can cope with at first before they descend into the emotional life. So I think there's different ways in for different people. You know, if one size fit all, you wouldn't need 50 speakers at the conference, right? Right. Exactly. We would have found the best one and sold the shit 80. Out of it by now. Yeah. 80. Wow. Good job, Alex. Second biggest trauma event ever. Alex, if you're
I knew you were going to get that in there.
Me and Alex have a brotherly competition a little bit going on. We were very good friends, though, actually. Should be seeing him next week. So where was it? Yes. So different ways in for different people. No one way.
And I would say also probably at different times too, right? Like if you're working with somebody over the course of 10 years, the way into a stage of healing when you first meet them might be completely different than when they encounter kind of another plateau of difficulty and approach you and you're like, all right, it's time for us to pivot. There's another way into this.
Yeah, like I needed that rigid Japanese martial arts when I began. Now that would just make me anal and uptight. I mean, after a while, I started doing, conscious dance and free dance and letting it all hang out, like doing different practices, and then I could sit and meditate, and that was beautiful. And, over time, I find different things work over time. Like I love, for example, EMDR. There was a time when that was just what I needed, very targeted. Or I love TRE, David Boselli, my older brother in the humanitarian field, which is was my own background. And then there's other times TRE just doesn't touch what I need. Working in Ukraine, we taught tapping, we taught a shaking modality, very like TRE. We taught, various other modalities, various other things. And some people would say, oh, the tapping, I just did tapping with a room full of kids and they loved it. It was brilliant. All the kids, much more relaxed now, much happier. Other people would come back in and say, hey, did the tapping, did nothing. Had zero impact. Total waste of time. And I'd say, cool, try the shaking. So you need a few things. And I think it's difficult now because there's actually quite a lot of money in the trauma world now. The trauma big stars have become rock stars, which is totally hilarious to me. And I started studying with a guy called Paul Linden, let's see how long, about 20 years ago now, who is my mentor in this field. He works with martial arts and trauma. That's how I sort of got into trauma, through the martial arts. Great guy. And the idea that there could be trauma rock stars was hilarious. That was just a completely ridiculous idea at that point. And there's a lot of money in it now. So everyone's got their brand and their trademark, and they want to say their modality is the best. And we should be a little suspicious of that, a little cautious of that.
Well, we were talking before we hit record. I was saying, you call it embodiment. Kathy Macchiodi might call it expressive arts therapy, and Peter Levine calls it somatosensory. And it's all, to me, I'm not the expert, but to me, it's all versions of the same thing where we're trying to get people back in their bodies, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's certainly commonalities, and they have more in common than they maybe do different. I'd say it's a danger to say they're all the same. I mean, I don't do arts therapy particularly. For example, we might get the crayons out occasionally on a course, but it's not my particular modality. So, and different things do have. It's not just a matter of saying different things work for different people. That's one level, but I think we can also say for these people at these times, certain things may be more appropriate. So, for example, I've worked all over the world, and certain things go down better in different places culturally. For example, like I've worked in slums of Brazil, and I've worked in Ethiopia and circus. I've worked in Russia and Ukraine a lot, Afghanistan, and different places are going to respond to things differently. It's one of the dangers, actually, so much is coming out of Northern California, if I'm going to be honest, is it doesn't always match culturally with a lot of the places where people might need help.
Well, and it's interesting that you say that because a lot of what I've been hearing, thinking about, and seeing lately is a lot of work around boundaries, which are great, but some of the work around boundaries and kind of family legacies and family systems, and for some, I don't know, white Americans, if you will, like setting boundaries with their parents can be easier than it would be for first generation Americans whose parents were immigrants from all over the world. They have different cultural backgrounds. Or saying, like, I don't want you to talk to me like that, or your expectations are too higher. Like setting all these boundaries are not only anathema to what they have had in their history, but like culturally, like unacceptable. And so taking people's cultures into the way that
It's
you're going to
huge.
work, yeah.
Yeah, looking at, some cultures are much more collective. America's highly individualistic. British people, we have a sense of humor, which is important. And so, like, I tell a lot, like, I do bait
A
when I do a
different one
basic
than
in.
Californians
No,
all
we have one. We have one. That was a joke. Like, I use a lot of jokes, and I'm trained by Jewish teachers, and that Jewish humor is actually a part of Jewish culture. You'll hear Paul Linden make all kinds of jokes that you'd be face palming and hitting the stop the live transmission button if you heard. You think I'm bad. So, like, there are different cultures. I'm from an Irish background. Irish have a certain way of doing things, a certain way of handling trauma. So has some things in common with the Ukrainians. My Irish family got on pretty well with my wife's family at our wedding. The English family less so, actually. It's interesting. The Irish had some nice trauma bonding and some nice trauma coping strategies in common, but slightly different, actually. Some countries using alcohol more. That's relevant. The sense of humor I mentioned, hyperarousal. Well, who says? Israeli level, right? Italian level. Like, what counts? What
Yeah,
counts?
exactly. Well, for assessing arousal, whose cultural arousal are we talking about?
Yeah, and also just like diversity, like what kind of diversity? Yeah, we need to take into account, you know, often I'll see a conference and it'll be like, it's really diverse because there's different colors of Americans. And I'll be like, okay, so I have Hungarian staff. Like, they have a whole different trauma history, right? And you just 100%. Go, well, they're white. They're Hungarian. Like, their country's been trodden on by everyone. So where do they get included in this? If we're going to take an American model that says, well, what matters is gender, sexuality, and ethnicity, according to the United States way of looking at this.
Right.
So I think we do need to have a slightly less provincial, more kind of global way of looking at this. And I'd have been eaten, you know, I worked lots, for example, in the gay community in Moscow. If I'd have turned up there and done British style, let alone American style, I would have been eaten alive. I would have been lesbian lunch. Just would not have gone down well. So it's like, we do have to accommodate some of these cultural differences and understand that there is huge bias in where we're coming from.
Absolutely. Could not agree more. I want to come back because I don't want to skip over what you started kind of to talk about Ukraine project. And so your wife is Ukrainian? Am I understanding that correctly?
So, yeah. I met my wife as my interpreter in the, so the war currently existing is the sort of second part of a longer war. So I actually went out there to do some coaching work. And then the war broke out. There was the invasion, sort of Russian-backed invasion. And they said, hey, can you do a trauma workshop? And I said, yes, sure. But there wasn't really much money. So I said, yeah, okay, I'll do it. But, you know, this might be the last time I come here because I didn't have any particular connection at that time. So the person hosting me made sure that all my interpreters were beautiful, wise, single women. One of them I fell in love with, and that was Daria, my wife. And then I got very deeply involved in Ukraine and training coaches, soldiers, therapists. Obviously when the war broke out, the new version of the war, I was quite impacted by that. And I was actually going to go fight. I felt so strongly about it. And then I phoned a couple of people, including Alex. I said, Alex, I'm going to go fight. He said, Mark, that's a terrible idea. You'll get shot. You'll be a terrible soldier. He said, but you are a very good trauma trainer. I said, so Alex, probably the reason I'm alive right now. I said, good idea, Alex. I'll do a trauma project. Probably the second or third week of the invasion, we raised a bunch of money, delivered some medical supplies to a children's hospital that was sort of cut off because Kiev was surrounded at that point, and that's where the supplies had come from. So we delivered the medical supplies, and then we trained a bunch of trainers in trauma education. So I spoke to local therapists, and they said, look, we're overwhelmed. We can do the therapy, but we need people to do basic trauma education and what's called trauma first aid. And that can be trained relatively quickly. So just a completely crazy project that should never have worked. I ended up out there. I went to local university. I said, give me a psychology PhD students as my assistants. Went to the local convent, said, give me your nuns as assistants. I've got a bunch of nuns involved. And then we did the training, which was a very intense training. I mean, as you can imagine, particularly as it kept getting interrupted by rocket fire, we did, you know, ended up doing half the training in a bomb shelter. And we did a training that went well. Went back, did another one, and now eventually I sort of gave the project over to sort of local women who are running it. Jenny and Kate, they're running it. They get Red Cross funding, and they've trained many thousands of people now. All the doctors and nurses in Lviv, all the school teachers in Lviv, many of the soldiers in the country, a bunch of kids as well. And their vision is to make Ukraine the world's most trauma-informed country, which is a beautiful, positive vision. Sadly,
I just got goosebumps. That makes my heart swell. I wish it wasn't necessary. Right. But, and you said such a great thing that I also want to bring back because it's such a universal concept, which is that you can't heal and integrate people's trauma when they're still being hurt. Right. So that the idea of like the trauma first aid, like we're not trying to like, right. We are literally still in crisis. They are still fighting. And so we're not going to be integrating and necessarily healing because they're still under attack, right?
Yeah. My mother-in-law was covered in dust from a bomb a few weeks ago.
I don't mean to interrupt you. Zoom can be difficult sometimes, right? But I think it just universally applies. And so many people can relate to that because often we're trying to heal. And obviously we're not literally at war, but our bodies feel like we are because we're still in the situations in which we're being activated or hurt, or, you know, we're in a relationship with a narcissist or something where it feels to our body like we're in a battle. Obviously, it's different in Ukraine, but the idea of like having to have actual physical, mental, emotional safety before you can heal, but that there's also work that can be done on the way there.
Yeah, it was kind of amuses me slightly when I hear this word safety being used. You know, it was when I did the project, I sort of, I'm very lucky, like Alex, I'm in contact with a lot of people in this field. And with the exception of David Baselli, most of them have never really been kind of frontline anywhere. You know, they've got practices in very pleasant places. And the sort of the idea of safety has become extended. That being said, you know, I always say the first time I worked in a war zone, it felt like home to me because that was before I healed my own nervous system. I felt like I, you know, grew up in a war zone, you know, an alcoholic household. And the joke with my Israeli friends is the more trauma healing I get, the harder work I find Israel, because I'm not in that. Because when you're in Israel, there's a, obviously from the Holocaust, from all the wars that have been there, there's a cultural trauma that's just there. It's in the air. Like the Tel Aviv is a wonderful city, but it's not a relaxed city. And same in Moscow, more numbing than hyperarousal there. And, you know, I've done a lot of healing work sort of since those days. And it was very interesting being in Ukraine, having done a lot of that healing work. But it was also a resource, you know, as I sort of said to these guys, you know, like when the first kind of rocket siren sounded and I said, okay, everyone jumps up and starts running for the bomb shelter. I said, look, just take a breath. Okay, let's walk. A lot of people get hurt kind of running to bomb shelters. So I said, just take a breath. We still got 3 minutes. Let's go. And you could see people trust me. And they said, oh, you know, how come, you know, I said, this is not my first rodeo. And I think the gift of post-traumatic growth for many of us is significant. And there is a natural urge to want to pass that on. And I think, you know, the trauma world maybe should get a grip a little bit in what counts as trauma now. There's a spread of that term. And of course, there's a subjective element of it. You know, overwhelm can be caused by many things. So what's to say? And it feels to me like the trauma world almost needs a reset of the language so that we can include kind of scales of different experiences, some of which are simply annoying. You know, everybody's hashtag triggered now. It's like, come on, guys, get over yourself. You know, but being offended on Twitter is not the same as being bombed in Kiev. It's not the same.
Yeah. Well, and I've given a lot of thought to this lately of kind of the levels of development in for an individual person in trauma awareness and growth and healing. Right. And so I found, and this is an informal study based on the feedback we get from the Trauma Super Conference.
Go on. Yeah. Go on. I'm right? interested.
So I'll get more emails now, but so it feels like, you know, when you first find out about that trauma exists and you might have it, like that is the lens you have glued to your face. Everything is trauma.
Everyone is trauma
to you, right?
And let me jump in. Let's play a game. Tell me anything about your life and I'll tell you how it's a trauma symptom. Anything, hit me, anything at all. Just tell me any random fact.
Now I'm like, I'm really annoyed by the truck. I did not know the utility truck that's outside, like chopping down a tree right now.
Okay. Well, clearly the tree represents your own vulnerability. The truck represents your own disembodied powers, and obviously irritability means hyperarousal, right? Yeah. One more. Tell me anything. Tell me what food you like. Anything.
What food do I like? Eggs. I had eggs this morning.
Well, eggs clearly represents the potential that you have, which has been squashed by trauma. Therefore, your obsession with eating eggs. Do you see what I mean? Like, we can just turn everything. And it is a useful lens, but it's also kind of a dark lens. It's like, do we want to just see the world through that lens?
I feel like it's a stop. It's a stop. It's like rarely do people get around that stop on that train line in growth, right? They have to be, and nobody can tell how long somebody's going to need to stay at that stop, right? Where their entire identity.
This denial before that, right? Like, I remember being a therapist and going, yeah, I mean, I've been in some war zones and my dad was an alcoholic and I've done this, this, and this, and I've been beaten up and assaulted, but I don't think I've got trauma. What are you talking about? Like, there's denial, and then there's that stage, and then there's kind of and you know, there's also a stage of denial of one's own responsibility. Like, it's like people have to own a victim narrative. Like, I've been hurt, someone abused me, that's not okay. And then they have to let go of that, or else they hang on to that and weaponize it. And that's what we're seeing, you know, the weaponized victimhood is what we're seeing across the world now.
Where we want everyone else to change to make us feel safe. right?
Right. So you can either wear shoes or you can coat the world in leather.
And again, right? It makes sense to me that that's what people want, right? Like it they totally makes world. Sense. It makes sense. Of course we do. But guess what? Spoiler alert. That's not going to happen, right? So that next, the next step is, in my experience anyway, is blaming everybody. You know, you blame everybody else. Everybody else is the villain, like we just said.
You're innocent. And the victim is holy in our culture. We've made the victim a... If victim blaming is one of the first thing, worst things, crimes on the internet, right? So we've made the victim a holy institution in the absence of any real values. And as you say, that can really, people can really get stuck there, and that's not great for their healing. And at a certain point, I tell people, you know, you are victimized. That's really not okay. And another point we need to move on from that.
Yeah.
And interestingly, as a society, I think we're going through kind of big picture versions of the same kind of individual process.
And I don't think either of us is denying that people are victims of, you know, hate and abuse, right? Neither of us is denying that. Those things are objectively true. You were mistreated. Yeah. You deserved better. You were hurt. The other person was wrong, right? Like those things are not debatable. But
well, even the language creep though, right? So to jump in again, but like, for example, yeah. Someone would say there was harm done. Like we used to use harm, you know, or words of violence. It's like, well, if words of violence, then self-defense involves cutting down freedom of speech. So if we allow this language of trauma to go into the general culture, we're actually allowing a certain kind of control to happen, because it's like you have to control the world to feel safe if you can't control yourself, right? And I think that's deeply dangerous for the world. And allowing this sort of language creep into other areas, it's not naive to call words violence and say harm was done, therefore. Blah, blah, blah. So what are we talking about here? We're talking about upset feelings, or are we talking about real trauma? Like, let's, like we're adults here. Like, it's also to do with the fact that trauma comes from therapy. So if someone walks into a therapy office, they're a vulnerable person. There's a certain kind of relationship, and we can assume vulnerability. But I don't want to assume that. I want to assume basic adult robustness. Like if you come to my trainings, I'm going to swear. I'm going to make jokes. We're going to talk about sex. It's not going to be trigger warning. We're just grown-up space. So it's not your college campus in Berkeley. Like this is grown-up place. This is an educational space. And I think the psychologization of normal life, you know, everyone's ex-boyfriend's now a narcissist, or everyone's ex-girlfriend is a sociopath. You know what I mean? It's like, you just don't like them. They're your
well,
ex.
Well, and I got to be honest, the psychologists I talk to are the worst about this. Everybody that's their ex has a, you know, personality disorder.
Who like, picked those people, number one? Okay, exactly. Like, number one, if someone picked those people, maybe they've got the problem.
I'm like,
and it's just, but it's a power. See, the Soviets did this. If I can say that you're mad, I can do what I can lock you up forever. I mean, that's even more powerful than saying you're bad. Anyone who disagrees with us is either bad or mad. It's very childish, actually. You know, you smell.
It is.
But to say you're mad is a huge power move. Because as soon as we say someone's mad, they no longer have any human rights. We can do what we want with them. You know, that's it's either evil or mad. And both of those are not are dehumanizing in a way.
Absolutely. I mean,
oh, soapbox, right? And this is the lead edge. The lead edge is actually integrating conservative principles into trauma theory. So I did a poster that was very popular about Gabor Mate versus Jordan Peterson. And I like Gabor Mate a lot. He was a big part of our first conference. I think his work's just a work of genius, and you know, I highly recommend it to everyone. But thoroughly nice man too. And he's got half the picture. Gabor Mate's mum, in traditional cultures would say mum, sexism, traditional cultures, not now. He says, it's not your fault. Of course, you're doing your best. It's not your fault, right? That's the liberal side of things, which is great. And it's true. And he's saying social conditions matter, which is a definition of sort of liberality. Social conditions do matter. It does matter about your ethnicity and your level of poverty is always the one that's ignored in America, right? Money matters a whole lot more than everything else. I'm sorry, but it does. And he's right about that stuff. But then Jim Peterson says, come along, clean your room, take responsibility, stand up straight, do your best. Life is hard. Do your best. You know, he's dad, strict dad. You know, could be in your family. It might be a strict mom. And you know. And they're both right. I like them both. But I'm not going to choose sides. Like they don't like each other. But it's, I think they're both right. And in from the trauma world, it's all come from mum. It's all come from a
right.
View of
and that, I could go, now it's my side. Turn to be on a soapbox. Yeah. Mom's to blame for it. Doesn't matter what happens. End of the day, mom's to blame. Yeah.
Yeah, but that view of it's not your fault, which is right, but it is your responsibility.
There was a man who I actually just Googled the other day because I was like, I wonder what he's up to. But his name was Fred Kaufman, and I met him 20 years ago. And he used to say response able, right?
Oh, yeah. Great. Yeah. And I liked him a lot. Yeah. I know who you mean now. Integral business guy.
Yes.
From Chile.
Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Fred Kaufman's great. Response
able. He would just say you are response able. And that's, I mean, 20 years later, I just quoted it to you. And that's what I always think of when I think of trauma healing and trauma growth. It's like, you're not absolved of responsibility just because you got hurt or because you experienced something horrible. Like, you're still responsible. And that's what all of trauma work boils down to, is being able to respond instead of react.
And I tell you, when I'm in Ukraine, they are responsible. Those, the people that in the team, and mostly women, because most of the men are fighting.
Right.
And kick-ass women, badass, strong women, but super feminine, and they like men. They're not, they will say things like, our men are so noble and so brave, and we love them so much fighting to protect us. And I go, oh my God, it's nice to hear that as a man. You know, not it's the patriarchy, right? Yeah, like you hear that and you're just like, oh, thank you. I'd love to hear more of that in Berlin and California and all the other places that have forgotten that. But they don't lose any kick-assness. I mean, these are strong, capable women. Right. And they're certainly not claiming victimhood, even though that they're literally being bombed on a daily basis. You know, they're getting on with it. The amount of can do I see in Ukraine is huge.
Yeah, absolutely. It's the inconvenience alone would disable the entire.
You know, once I was having sushi in Lviv, right? And the sushi was just coming, and then a rocket attack happened. And the waiter tried not to deliver the sushi. We got really upset and insisted that he give us the sushi so we could take it to the bomb shelter. We almost didn't get sushi. It's pretty bad. I'm joking, of course. There are people who are suffering horribly, including friends of mine and family of mine. But it's very surreal, actually, being in a place where you can eat sushi and be bombed at the same time. But the power outages is not great there right now. The winter they're suffering is pretty great, and also it's just winds people down. You know, the beginning of the war, there was a adrenaline, there was a, you know, a kind of surge, and then, you know, kind of, what are we, 9 months later, there's it does wind people down. And what the Russian military is doing is absolutely atrocious. I've got very little time for conspiracy theories about this, because it's I hear firsthand accounts, and the things that are being done out there are, oh, absolutely. You know, I'm not going to say it here because the context of people listening, but really atrocious, worse than people can imagine. And I hear the firsthand accounts, so I know it's true. And do support those people who are doing that. Like I said, it's not my charity anymore. I'm giving it away. Send Ukraine, and there's like other lots of other great groups out there as well. But yeah, also hope in that every other war in human history, literally, was trauma unaware. And usually what would happen is they'd learn about trauma after the war and then forget it. So we had shell shock, and then we had combat fatigue, and then we had PTSD. But it was always afterwards and never during, because the Ukrainians see this as Western, and they see Western as good, and i.e. not Russian. The Russians aren't trauma aware. I don't give a shit. But it's because they see it in a positive Western light, it's there currently. Which, I mean, my ideal world would be one without war. My second ideal world would be one with its trauma aware. And that can end the cycles of war. So if we see, you know, some of the atrocities the Russians are doing, it's because, not an excuse, but they've also been brutalized themselves. Right? So we have these cycles of hurting people. We have these cycles of numbness and trauma repeating. And you can interrupt those cycles. You know, in the Bible, it says the sins of the father will be visited onto the son for 5 generations. And I say, not with good trauma therapy. We can fix that. So honestly, there is hope.
And
there
we won't hope. Know the effects of, well, maybe we will. Maybe I shouldn't speak like that. But we won't know the effects of creating a trauma-aware culture in the midst of war for probably 5 to 10 years to come, right? Like, we'll see how impactful that was. Sure. And my guess is incredibly impactful.
Yeah. I mean, the fact that school teachers are with the kids, and the nurses are with people in the hospital, the doctors, and I already see it. You know, I see, you know, I've been around a few wars, and you see the hooks of hate get into people. And to see that not happening, you know, and people are still defending themselves, right? It doesn't mean being a pushover. Is already obvious to me as someone who's, you know, talked to people in Afghanistan and places like that.
This actually brings me to my last question that I wanted to ask you, and everything's lined up beautifully for it. Thank you. which is that people have this perception of embodiment and nervous system regulation as being this person that's like unshakable and undeterred and calm regardless of what they're facing. And so for you, and I expect, I don't know the answer to this, but from your experience and from what the little I know about you, I'd love if you could address that kind of assumption and misnomer about this, like this kind of, you know, idealized sense of calm that we assume we will arrive to.
Why don't I answer that question in the yoga voice? No. Exactly. So, yeah, I mean, I'm feeling it now, you know, talking about Ukraine, I can feel my emotional response to that. There's a certain welling up there. There's all sorts of emotions present right now. I think pretending to be calm is one sort of spiritual image, you'd see different versions of that. You see it in the martial arts, you know, the fake martial artist, the yoga teacher, the different versions of it. Thinking that niceness is the same as, you know, like I'm fierce. My Ukrainian team are fierce, you know. It's like that, I think, can come with it. We shouldn't sort of culturally associate pleasant niceness with trauma healing. I'd like to see more passion in trauma, more cheekiness, more play, more sexiness. I think trauma healing often just looks a bit bland. It's like, where's the pepper? You know, like, where's the color? So I think those things come in with real trauma healing, as opposed to trying to make everything safe, which is impossible and just ends up neurotic and controlling. The affectation of calm is popular and a shame.
Mm. I like that answer. Yeah. And I think it really does pay to have a variety of different approaches, as we've said, you know, full circle, because a lot of people will completely respond to what you said. Like, they do want the play and the fun and the spiciness and the pepper in their trauma healing and growth. And
people are in Portland and have blue hair. Listen, if you're watching this and you're in Portland and you have blue hair, just email Alex Howard at don'tgiveashit.com. And then we'll use it for toilet paper. We'll print your email out. So no,
he never does that. We read them all.
There's cups of tea for different people. Some people love a bit of Gabor. Some people love a bit of, I don't know, Steve Hoskinson is someone I really appreciate in this space. Lawrence Heller, I really appreciate in this space. Irene Lyon, you know, there's so many different people. And we need someone making rude jokes and flirting with Slavic women and talking about sushi. We need that. That's important. We need this full spectrum, not just clones of Northern Californians.
Agreed. Mark Walsh, how can people find out more about you? Obviously, your Ukraine organization that you've surrendered over to other people now. How can people support your work and find out more about you?
If you put the word embodiment into the internet, I will come up. So the embodiment book on Amazon, the embodiment podcast. Our main one is Embodiment Unlimited. Embodiment Unlimited, it's an app and a website, so you can get the app. And that's got loads of free resources, including loads of free trauma resources on, including some of the big names at this conference. So embodimentunlimited.com or the app, or they can find me on podcasts, on Amazon, on the internet, on Tinder, but everywhere. You missed that joke.
No, I just didn't think it was funny, Mark.
It's been really nice to meet you. It's been a real
wonderful
pleasure.
Wonderful to meet you, too.
It's been real. You're better than Alex. Tell Alex next time I don't speak to him, speak to you again.
Maybe I don't have to tell him.
Tell him. He knows that.
He's going to feel it in the universe. Thank you so much, Mark Walsh.
Pleasure.